We have a full agenda. We would invite the chancellor to come forward and to begin his presentation on the higher education and the wonders of new technology online here.
Thank you very much, Senator, members of the committee, and I will echo your hopeful enthusiasm about the wonders of technology. You also wonder whether these things actually will work when you press the button, so I'll hope that that happens. If I could make a brief and personal comment at the beginning to thank you for the opportunity to be with you. This is the first opportunity I have had to testify before a Senate committee, and indeed my second opportunity for testimony in the legislature. It is indeed a privilege to be here representing this system, and as someone new to this state, I can tell you that I am indeed very, very proud to be part of the state of Oregon and part of this extraordinary university system. I went through a whole lot of examining different university systems around the country last year, and I can tell you this is a particularly fine one that you have built over a period of years, and there's much to be proud of and much to be appreciative of, and I personally am very proud to be part of that. So thank you for the opportunity to be here. We've titled today's talk Crunch Time for Oregon's Public Universities, Holding the Line on Quality, and I guess that's the theme that we'd like to try and leave with you today, is that while we are very proud of our accomplishments and feel that we have made great strides, this is indeed a time of great pressure for us in the public system. The crunch is brought about by a number of trends with which you're all, of course, permanently familiar. And many of them are things that we've known for a while, we've seen coming for a while, but they're coming together at the moment in a particularly challenging way. Our rising enrollments are, of course, why we are in higher education. Public education exists to provide that opportunity. And so we're proud of that, but it's coming at a time of necessarily declining state support, as other claims bear upon your needs. A time of declining financial aid, which is a major crisis for us. We are seeing that reaching places that it's not been before. And a time of severe deferred maintenance backlog, which is reaching a serious level for us. And all of that put together means that we are looking at a very tough equation of quality and access. Now, how can we maintain access and maintain quality and recognize that those two things have to indeed happen together? The crunch is captured a little bit on this graph, and you can see two chapters in our history. A chapter in the early 1990s where the impact of Measure 5 exerts a devastating set of consequences upon our enrollments, which remain even for a period of some 6 or 7 years. And I can't find another state in the country which went through that kind of devastating shakeout of flat enrollments for its public four-year sector. That's a missing generation of Oregonians who lost the opportunity to come to our institutions. About 98 or so, it starts to pick up again, and thanks to the very good work that you all helped us with in 99 and onwards, we see then the growing trend that takes us through this year and the projected increasing growing trends that will continue as the pipeline and as the demographics of our state project increased number of students. I'd like to come back to this graph a bit later and explain to you why I think, in fact, the number around 2010 would be even higher than projected here if we had an opportunity to meet it. But here there are two chapters. What happens in the early 90s? It is indeed possible to close down a system of public higher education, and then the very good responses to the impetus of 99 and beyond.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Dr. Decker. Chancellor, do you know who that was? Have we done research? I have an inkling who it is that we lost, that generation in the early 90s who just either didn't show up or were costed out of the system.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Decker, I think there are two factors that we're able to trace back. One is a cost factor, as tuition soars at that point in time, and the other is the word got out that quality was being stressed and that these institutions were eroding in the quality that they had achieved. And I think we've got survey data to show that that word gets out. Once that gets out, it becomes very difficult to recover the enrollment on that base. And that's when people stop away and or find other options. Hmm. The concern is, in fact, the number of people who just stopped away And you do not find a corresponding large growth in the community colleges, for example. A lot of people just stayed out of higher education. And that, I think, is the state public policy crisis that happens when the system closes down, so to speak. So those increasing enrollments, of course, have taken place at a time of declining state funding, and one understands the reasons for that, some turnaround after 99, but we're now looking at a much more difficult situation in terms of state support, as you know, as you faced those decisions. At the same time, the pressure on financial aid has become truly appalling in our state. If we look through from the period from 1999 through to this year, 2002-03, you see a steady increase in the number of students who would be eligible for the Argonne Opportunity Grant. The truly needy students in our state grows from some 30,000 to over 54,000. The number of awards inches up barely over that period. So we have a gap now between the number of eligibles and the number of awards that is of the order of 30 to 35,000 students. That's a devastating pressure for students to bear, and a tiny contribution to the need for students to support their education. So that is a primary concern for us, and we raise that as a major issue. While all that's taking place, we have, of course, as you know, been struggling with maintenance of a physical plant for the last decade or so. Half of our buildings were built between 25 and 40 years ago, and that means their internal systems are all aging at the same sort of time. The subsystems for heating, ventilation, roofing, etc., are all reaching that point where attention is necessary. Buildings and systems need to be addressed simultaneously, and at this point, our current backlog for deferred maintenance is exceeding $500 million. So that, too, is something that we can, in a sense, no longer leave off the list and keep hoping it will get better. And so that's why we're here today. Can we make a pledge, reach an understanding, hold out a hope for holding the line on quality? And that's the most important word that I'd like to leave with you throughout the rest of this presentation afterwards today. This is my one attempt at mild humor and to give you a hope that we're moving on through the talk. The image on the right is meant to indicate the horse with the blinders on, that we've all been racing hard. You have, we have. And when you race hard and focus on the crisis of the moment, what happens is you lose track of what else is going on. There are a lot of other unintended consequences of good intentions, good aims that take place. And as a result, when you take off for that jump with the snowboard, it's not entirely clear what lies beneath. We hope it's deep snow and not the rest of the cliff face. Much of the rest of this talk is going to suggest that it might be the rest of the cliff face. We believe we are a system that has demonstrated a strong commitment to accountability and performance measures. We've been at this a time, and we're proud of what we do here. We recognize the efficiency measures put in place in 95 through Senate Bill 271, followed those up in 97 with goals established in Senate Bill 919, and have followed those performance measures since. And those are how we judge how we are doing. We've got four major goals for the system: providing access, building quality programs, creating economic opportunity and employability, and managing for cost effectiveness. Under each of those, we monitor our campuses annually, at least annually, and track the performance on each of these major dimensions. And that's been, I think, a strength of this system, and known again nationally as a system that has committed itself to accountability and performance measurements. And I'd be happy to come back at another time and go through those in any detail as you wish. But I can tell you that they are showing healthy and positive developments over the last several years.
Yes, Senator Morstead.
Thank you. Chancellor, the last line on the slide, current fund balances, gifts, grants, contracts, so on. You now have the prerogative to bring money in that you have control over. Now, are you... And I, you know, this is a question, because in lean times we look at what we didn't do in good times. Now, are you planning to set some money aside if you're able to, or even if you're not able to, are you going to be setting money aside, which I'm sure you're probably doing already, to get over, to kind of even this thing out?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marcet, to the degree possible. Our fund balances have taken a serious beating this year as continued pressures have mounted upon them. So they're not what they used to be. And they are reaching levels that are a real concern for our finance office.
I understand.
We're in that time, the timing crunch of cuts coming late in the biennium.
I understand.
But we do look at that very carefully, and it's our intent to address those just as soon
because
as we can.
Because I think every prudent person does that in their own lives. They set some money aside, and I know it's in good times we don't want to talk about it because, you know, but in bad times we wish we had, and in bad times we should be looking ahead. So I hope that there is a way that we can, that you can figure out to how to set that. Now, may I? I'm noticing that the Beaverton School District will not be closing early this year. The Beaverton School District is in relatively good shape. The Bethel School District in Lane County, the Springfield School District, 4J is not in good shape, and all of that goes back to the prudent management and so on. That, you know, a lot of it has, there are a lot of reasons for it, but the fact that. And I'm sure that if we look at the institutions of higher ed, we might find some of those differences too, that there are some institutions that are less likely to hurt than others. So I think that's something that I think is extremely important, that you have something built into your plans. So, because we're going to have the good times again, then we're going to have the bad times, and you know, it would be nice if we could kind of even things out over those periods.
Yes, sir. Certainly agree.
Thank you.
We do believe we're a substantial service to the state, and sometimes the dimensions of that get a little lost. The fact is that the different campuses within our system touch the lives of a million Oregonians a year, whether it's through teaching or research or public service in the world of extension. We are a substantially growing system. We've grown by 14,000 students since 1992. And we're anticipating, if we were able to support it, growth of that rate or more in the next decade. So this is a state for which the demographics alone would drive continued and substantial growth of demand for enrollment. There are also, as I'll point out in a few moments, additional populations that we would like to reach and believe should reach. We believe we're at the core, we're a part of what the state needs to define its future in a knowledge-driven economy. Our faculty are active and successful in competing for research grants and bring in over $250 million a year in sponsored research. And at the present time, our students, our graduates, and the employers who employ them express high degrees of satisfaction of the order of 7 out of 10, highly satisfied with the education they've received, the skills their employees bring, and their personal satisfaction with the institution that they went to. So in a lot of ways, I'm here presenting to you the case for concern over institutions that are still performing very well. It is the ability to continue to perform very well that we worry about and that we believe is approaching the crunch. So let me, if I may, return to that graph on enrollment and now peek at the far right side of it and think a little bit about what that means. And you'll see I've done a bit of tinkering with the red lines there and said, what does it mean if we continue to plan as we have done, the blue dots? And the blue dots are the pipeline. That's what's coming out of K-12. That's what's coming out of our community colleges. Those are the students that return to our state from other states. And that if we continue to enroll at the rates we have done from those typical populations, we would expect to see our enrollment grow, were we able to support them, from the current 78,000 students this fall to something of the order of 93,000 students or so in about 2010. If, however, we look at other populations in our state, other populations at other states serve more aggressively than we do, I would argue that there is, in fact, additional demand in our state for other populations that would drive the demand for our institutions rather more steeply than the blue line. It would, in fact, be reaching 100,000 student need by 2010 rather than 93,000. And let me illustrate what I mean by that. The pipeline contains all of the pieces we know. High school graduates, continuation rates, how many continue from graduation into a two-year or four-year school within a year of graduation, transfers from the community colleges into our institutions, transfers from other four-year schools, returnees from out of state, And I would suggest we're also going to see a substantial growth in demand for master's education, as most of the country is experiencing that need for further credentialing in a world in which more and more technical communications and qualifications are needed. Those are standard pipeline demographics. We're pretty good at estimating those, as a matter of fact, and we serve those pretty well. But there are, in an increasingly knowledge-driven economy, a large group of other folks who came in and stopped out of our institutions. And I like to look at those students who come to us and then for one reason or another stop out. The freshman class that came onto our campuses last fall, something like a third, will not be there next fall. And they will not, a relatively few of them, will have flunked out for academic reasons. The majority of them will not be there next fall because life got in the way. And life will get in the way in the form of a relationship, a need for employment, a need for earnings, a need to find, to take, to provide care to a family member, a need to raise a family, and will indeed have a great deal to do with money. And those will be people who will be in our society, who will be marching through their 20s and 30s, and for whom the value of a four-year education is just as great as it was when they're 18. They're college-ready, they're college-oriented, but they're out there. Some of them will become re-entrants. Many more should. Many people now in our society are facing career change in their mid-years. That career change is now extending to baccalaureate and beyond education. Not simply narrow skill sets, but substantial areas in which change of focus and new skills are required. Professional development for continuing workers is now the norm in a knowledge-driven economy. And then the lifelong learners for whom the pursuit of knowledge itself is of great value. I call these, to come up with what I hope is a memorable phrase, the broken bachelors, the folks who are out there for whom completing a degree is the step to a new life and the expanded opportunities that we think about for our traditional students, but all too often don't quite remember so strongly for some of our older and non-traditional students. We think about those populations, that's what kicks the demand up from the low 90,000s to the 100,000 in 2010.
It just sounds like a show on Fox Television, The Broken Bachelor. So I'm thinking we might see this coming, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, if I could get a piece of that, I'd be happy to.
you get the royalties.
I'd be happy to.
Excuse me. As we're looking at this, it occurs to me that what is already happening with 24/7. Online education opportunities, that this is another way that the system can reach those and beyond students, because many of them, as you say, have real life situations that deny them the opportunity for an on-campus experience.
Indeed, Mr. Chairman, and that's something that all of our campuses are working on and reaching out to. It is important for these folks to recognize the value of their time. It's their most precious commodity. And the ability to serve that time and to bring education to them at the time they need it is critical in expanding this demand. But there is a substantial population here of talented folks who are part of the way there. And it's a group we really need to reach out to. And raised. They live here, they pay taxes, they're going to be with us. They are citizens of our state.
May I ask, what's the proper medium to give that type of person what they need? Now, I know there are some for-profit institutions that have come into existence specifically to deal with people who are working, who want to upgrade, and so on. Now, is the university system gearing itself to be more to appeal to those working professionals, some of them, or people who want to become professionals? Are you competing in the market successfully for those people? Or is that the domain of the private?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, we certainly are competing in that market, and we'd like to compete a whole lot more. Part of our challenge is we're full with the pipeline of production. And so much of this market has, in fact, devolved to some of the newer entrants. The challenge there is that the attrition rates for many of those newer entrants becomes very high indeed, because they lack the support structures to keep these students in school and keep them in their programs. So what we need to be able to do is to meet the pipeline and reach out into what is a very different set of student needs and demands. There is certainly no reason why we cannot serve these populations and serve them very well indeed. The key to understanding them is that there is no one model that fits all. That they're in fact best served by blended models that involve both online, in-person, and occasional on-campus visits. And it is the opportunity to blend those types of education that I think our institutions could excel at. So I would be hopeful that this will be an area in which we could seek major expansion over the next decade. We are, as you know, driven by a funding model called the Resource Allocation Model, or RAM, begun in 1999, a new way of doing business for the system, encouraging entrepreneurial activity and establishing the importance of enrollment management and funding following our students. It's a model that identifies the role of campus-based revenue as well as state tax funds. We bring in a great deal of revenue to support our activities, tuition and fees, sponsored program activities, auxiliary enterprises, gifts and grants. But the role that state tax funds play cannot be substituted by any other primary fund source, and it is that per-student support for particularly undergraduate instruction that is the core of the relationship between the state and our universities. The model provides these funds in a way that's student-centered, that is understandable, that holds us accountable to where the students go and the programs and levels that they enroll in, so that stakeholders know what they're buying, and it has a limited number of allocation elements and complexity. Now, having said that, this is still higher ed, so we can't eliminate complexity altogether. There are, in addition, lump sum pools for statewide public services, for state initiatives, and for the other activities that you see there. So we believe that we've got a model that has been developed with you all, with the state, in a way that's understandable and predictable, and that serves the needs of the system and of the state. A key part of that model is to relate our funding and our performance to those of peers. And it's that relationship to peers that I'd like to emphasize a bit today, because that's largely how we measure quality and think of quality in higher education. And we look at those universities from whom we will have to recruit our faculty, to whom we would wish to send many of our students, and with whom we have to compete when we go out seeking grants and contracts. It's our ability to remain in that top group, to remain in that list of premier institutions, that will determine the true quality of the Oregon University system. When you look at those lists of peers, and as you can see, we have different peers for larger universities, the regional universities, the Oregon Institute of Technology. When you look at those, it is our ability to remain competitive with those peers that is at risk at the moment. The Resource Allocation Model, or RAM, provides an index of how we're doing in terms of our funding relative to those of our peers. And so we've called it a quality funding index. How are we funded relative to those institutions with whom we wish to be compared for quality? We can express that index as a percentage of the median or average funding for our peers. How do we compare against the average for our peers? And we would hope that in the course of this session, we can come to an understanding with you, an agreement with you, on what would be a base for that relationship. What would be a limit below which we don't wish to stray, so that the quality of our system can be preserved. And we suggest that base be pegged at 20% below the median of our peers. We would obviously like to be funded at the median, the average. We'd like to be funded above the average. But we recognize where the state is, where we're struggling. So could we start at that point? However,
Senator Decker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Chancellor, I mean, the natural question on that is, what is the rationale for setting our sights at 20% below? And I think I just recently saw, and you would know the exact figures, that UCLA, the per-student allocation, I believe it was 3 to 4 times what the per-student state allocation to the University of Oregon, which are, you know, Pac-10 are somewhat comparable institutions. What is the rationale for continuing what would be, I think, just viewed, at least on the West Coast, as a dismal funding pattern for higher education and pegging ourselves at 20% of our peer institutions below?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Deckert, an attempt to arrest a period of decline and give us a floor from which to build. We don't want to stay at 20% below. As you'll see, if I may just refer to this graph by way of answering the question directly. In the good old days of 1999, 2000, 2001, our funding was 11 to 12% below the average. It slipped this year to some 28% below. And were we to continue to meet the enrollment demand we project for next year with the funding targeted in the current executive budget, that would drop us to a figure of some 35% below. Now, there's a relationship there then between the number of students that we can support and the level of that funding. The reason for suggesting a 20% figure is to say, at that point, we're starting to lose touch with the average funding of those peers. We could establish that as our base and pledge to grow from that as quickly as the state's recovery permits. That would move us back up again towards that average. So I would not want to settle for 20% below, though right now it would actually look pretty good.
May I,
as dismal as it is.
Kind of a follow-up question. It seems to me in 1999, Grattan, didn't we come up with a new model that we were supposed to fund?
The RAM.
And we didn't, right? Right.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Grattan Sharon's Director of Government Relations for the University System, Senator Morissette, you're absolutely correct. I have the chance to say in the good old days of just 4 years ago when the legislature approved the resource allocation model, we abandoned the old BAS model and went to this one where the dollars followed the student, tuition dollars stayed on the campus, and the campuses were really given encouragement to become entrepreneurial and market-based. The pledge was, this is as far as we can get you now, but we're going to get to the median in the future. The future did not permit that. The cut from our budget began in 2001, where almost $30 million was extracted from the budget. And now, since that time, $88 million more has been extracted from the budget during special sessions. We're facing now, on February 28th, potential of another allotment control cut. So in response to both of your questions and Senator Decker's, a floor in which we said the free fall stops here, which also has implications on how many students you enroll, would be the kind of bargain we need to have in order to say stability is established there and the free fall stops. We hope when we have a chance to turn the page, we'll see what our future might be.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So that's the crunch then that we are facing. Growing demand to which our campuses have accommodated by increasing the enrollments at a time of diminishing state resources compared to the funding index of our peers. And that's the downward trend that we're seeking to arrest and put a floor beneath. So that we can start to think about a future beyond that. The future that we'd ask for attempts to recognize that this is going to take a while. And we figure it will take at least three biennia to get back in sight of the conditions where we were in 1999. But if we could get back to 20% below this year, 15% below in the next biennium, and 10% below thereafter, we'd be back in striking range of the median. We recognize the condition that the state is facing. And by making this trade-off, we would be attempting to maximize access and maximize those students that we could handle while growing back the quality base that we so desperately need. So we're attempting to see that as a relationship with you, not as a trade-off or a choice, but as something we go into together and say, in order to maximize both, maximize access, preserve quality, can we put ourselves on a trajectory that would look something like this? That's going to take a challenge. If we look at the decade of the 90s, during the 90s, our state appropriations in dollar figures went up by 21%. Appropriations against the CPI showed a decrease of 4% at a time when our enrollment was going up by almost 10%. I think if you look at a 10% increase over a decade, 10% increase in enrollment against a 4% decrease in inflation-adjusted dollars, that's a pretty good measure of productivity increase. We did more with slightly less. And I feel proud of that as a rate of accommodation. But what's happened this biennium pales by makes that pale by comparison. Now we've seen a decrease of 1% in real dollars, 5% against inflation, at a time when we're still increasing 5 to 6% a year. We can't bridge that gap of a 5% reduction and an 11% increase by any form of productivity increase that I or anybody else in higher ed has seen. So we are, in fact, regrettably denying access, a fact we need to recognize and acknowledge. The loss of support means that there are academically qualified Oregonians who can't get an opportunity grant. In fact, well over half of the applicants, the eligibles for the opportunity grant, will be unfunded. The money will run out. There are also populations that aren't covered by that and that are completely left outside of the support system. Most part-time students, and that's most working adults, are not eligible for most financial aid. Many first-time-to-college students, many students from needy backgrounds, are unwilling or unable to take on the significant debt load that comes with financial aid largely packaged as debt. And it is simply not a solution to say you can take on these levels of debt in order to get through college. For many folks who come from outside the collegiate experience, those are debt burdens that they simply will not risk and so are cut out of the opportunity to go. We have denial of access of students who don't get into college. And that tends to be what most of us think about when you say, well, access is denied. You have a mental image of a bunch of students who tried to get in and couldn't. What I'm suggesting is we also suppress demand for those who don't try. And then we actually admit students who now find it increasingly difficult to get through our institutions, for whom increasing class sizes, reduced sections, and limited abilities to complete their programs are in fact extending their time in college, increasing the burden upon them to raise the money to do that, and delaying for them the opportunity to realize the increased income that a college a degree will bring. So we have access problems getting in, and bluntly, we have access problems getting out. We're denying access on entry and exit, and it is reaching a severe stage. We are turning to our students repeatedly. We are a high tuition, low aid state, and we have gone to our students all too frequently during these last rounds of crises. Our undergraduate resident tuition and fees are continuing to increase sharply. We received, I'm afraid, last fall, an infamous F on the affordability measure that is produced by the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education. And this is a state measure. It's not targeted only at those of us in the university system. It's really addressing us as a state and saying, how much support do we provide as a state for our citizens to go to college against the income typical of this state? It's not comparing our affordability against those states that have very high incomes. It's looking against our own base. And how do we line up? Well, two Western states received an F. There were five in the country. We, unfortunately, are one of those. And that means the ability of our students to access higher education is that much less than those in our neighboring states. How are we trying to get at this? How are we trying to deal with access, quality, affordability, and maintenance of our capital assets? And we've tried to put together a proposal that we've named the deal. How can we come up with a new partnership with you, the state of Oregon, that would be agreed to by the state, by the system, and by the students? We need a multi-biennial strategy. We can't get out of the hole we're in one biennium. It'll take too much. That puts together funding, access, and remembers quality. That takes us together to a partnership on access and quality. The most difficult thing is if the legislature becomes the champion of access and says, you must take all of the qualified students. And we are then left in the position of saying, but we can't do that at the quality you need. That pits us in a relationship of access against quality. And I would hope that we could come at that in a way that says we understand there is a relationship and we agree there's a base from which we can build. And that's the basis for understanding this relationship. It needs to put us all together. It needs to bring the state to the table, a student tuition package to the table, and a set of institutional efficiencies to the table. On the state side, what we would be hoping is that we could set that quality funding floor at 20% below the average in the coming biennium and then grow it over the next couple of biennia so that we got back to our 99 level, no less than 10% below, at the end of three biennium. It's also important to mention in this that although all of my conversation so far has been phrased in terms of access with a predominant emphasis on undergraduates, that a key part of what our universities do is also the research and extension work that they provide. And I think it's vitally important for the state to continue to invest in the research incentives that you have been part of in the past and that we desperately need to continue that aspect of what we do in the future. We are going to our students quite a lot. We need to establish with them a fair share relationship. And that fair share relationship is going to be a whole lot different than anything I've grown up with in higher education and that would have been conceivable a relatively few years ago. What we would be asking is that the state agree that it remains the senior partner in the funding of undergraduate education for its residents. That is, that if we look at the share borne by the state and the share borne by the students, the funding of undergraduate residents, that the state share not fall below 50%. And I have to say that's a number I didn't think I'd be talking about. I thought I'd spend my life talking about state shares of 60% or better. We're presently at 54-55% and falling. And I would hope that we could agree that the state share of 50% is a floor that we do not cross. In addition, it is important that we provide students with an understandable and predictable set of relationships for the tuition packages that they will encounter, and that they not be subject to the feast and famine cycles of artificially suppressed tuitions in good times and then huge spikes and repeated tuition surcharges in tough times. And bluntly, I think we need to direct a set aside of some of our tuition revenue to address financial aid for our neediest students. We are not going to close the gap of the Oregon Opportunity Grant in one or two or three biennia, despite the best efforts of all of us, and we're part of a coalition seeking to do that. But we too have to reach out to our neediest students and do something additional there. If we can bring those two partners to the table, the state and the students, the state contribution and the student tuition, it still will not make up the resources needed to drive this system. There will still be a gap. And for that, we're coming to you with a request, a package, for a set of institutional efficiencies to complete an approach that you embarked upon a number of years ago. That we would look to find ways in which we can recalibrate our relationship with you, not to reduce our accountability in any way, but to allow us to operate more efficiently, quicker, better, and cheaper, and to incent the campuses so that when they see the opportunity to behave in a more entrepreneurial way, they will be able to retain the benefits. When they see an opportunity, they can move more quickly, unhampered by a repeated pre-review and examinations. But please understand there is no attempt to withdraw in any way from the accountability requirements that are critical for the disposition of public funds. Let me take the opportunity to thank all of you here present for helping to sign and co-sponsor the bills that we've put in this area and emphasize how desperately important they are to us. We very much appreciate the indications you've given of interest and support in that area. So we hope then there would be a return on investment recognized by the state, that we would provide systems that give a competitive performance in measures of student success and faculty accomplishment. We'd see retention rates and graduation rates and faculty performance at levels that are clearly superior, that are above the average if we compare ourselves to our peers. And we would deliver that at a cost that is below the average of our peers, a below average cost to the taxpayers of our state, with a fair share relationship for the students, affordability preserved for those with the greatest financial need. We see a future in which recognize that enrollment demand is going to increase substantially, and we should encourage that and stimulate it, not continue to suppress and deny it. We recognize that we can contribute more, we wish to contribute more to the economic development of our state. We would pledge that if we can be put on a growth trajectory like this, we would double the level of our funded research and technology. We would continue the advances in our engineering initiatives that have been so successful and complete those on time and by 2010. And we would continue to expand our university outreach and public service as we have done. And we have more detailed sets of quantitative goals there. Nationally competitive performance, below average cost, fair share, affordability, and a margin of excellence. please help us to renew our commitment to growth and access. We may not get there in the next biennium, but the statements of this House and of this legislature to reach there eventually will be desperately important. The relationship between quality and access will determine the future of the system that you have built over the years. And financial aid is something we have to be part of the solution. The efficiency initiatives are essential. We can't do this without them. They're not a nice idea. They're an essential idea. And we would greatly appreciate your support for our bond program for deferred maintenance. And finally, just an aside, I've given you a presentation today that has focused entirely on quality and access. It feels like a very budgetary presentation to the Education Committee. And as I put this down, I felt that I had missed out a lot of the things that are the core values of these universities and the core values of the people who work in them and the students who come to them. And so I just throw out for you the fact that among the things we are most proud of and are most committed to, our diversity performance in increasing the diversity of our faculty, staff, and students has never been better in this system. We know how to do that. We're making progress. We have more to do. We believe we're collaborating across all education sectors in this state more than we ever have done. Closer partnerships with the community colleges, better transfer, more sophisticated co-admission dual enrollment programs, better relationships with K-12. Better than it has been, we know how to do that. We want to continue with that. We believe we're making good progress in research and our engineering initiatives. Our research dollar volume has never been higher. We're on target for the engineering initiatives to double. Please help us to continue those. There is a great deal to be proud of in this system that you have built, and I would look forward to a time when these could be the subject of our conversation and perhaps not quite so much of the picture that we've had to paint for you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions, Senator?
I haven't seen your LC drafts of your efficiency, but what about how would it impact student tuition rates? What do you want to do differently?
What we're looking to do on the student tuition side is to have the authority for setting the tuition allocated to the state board so that we do not put in a position where tuition is suppressed at a time when we need to find that balance point of tuition and state support and financial set-aside funds. So it would be asking not to have a restriction on expenditure controls that goes against the need for tuition that the campuses and the state board have asked for.
So in other words, the legislature would then give up that review process. Is that what you're talking about?
You would still, of course, have the authority to approve the budget. So I don't think in a sense, excuse me, Senator, forgive me, Mr. Chairman, you would not be giving up any ultimate control. But what we would ask you to do is to authorize the state board to come forward with tuition proposals that help close these gaps, and not to leave that always as the number that closes the budget at the end, and then beyond which we have no ability to adjust the rest of it.
Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor, that is a sobering report. I think I've heard it before, but with a couple ray of hope. I have a thought and then a couple of questions that might be embedded in it. I just recently finished the Oregonian series on China, which, if there was any doubt in my mind, the importance, and we've tended here to look at regional, whether it's California and Washington, competitive pressures, but certainly I think if there was any doubt that I still harbored, is that the global economy and the Pacific Rim's ambitions and very thoughtful ambitions to compete on higher ed, compete in the for manufacturing jobs, and compete. The one thing that I certainly took away from that was the one strategic advantage the United States has, still has, and it probably is the only one, because land, labor, environmental regulations, we won't be able to compete, is higher education. And so that's where at least the first 7 or 8 pages was at least a bit daunting. But I wanted to ask you about at least a couple of the successes that we've had, and the first would be engineering. I noticed recently that you've, and the budget, we've absorbed the hits that we've absorbed at the state, certainly the Chancellor's office have taken their share. I noticed that you have, or that we received the resignation of Bob Dryden, which, looking back at the last 5 to 7 years, has really been one where I think we've turned the corner on so many, and you mentioned them in your presentation, on the engineering initiative on ETIC, and just wanted to get a sense of where you see we're headed, whether it's ETIC or the OCATE Center, or just how the Chancellor's Office can play a central role, which y'all have done really, and this is kudos, such an impressive job for the last, I guess, decade, and really the state's made the commitment, but I think the system has made the commitment to reduce inefficiency and to really focus our resources, and I think we are making national progress, and I think the one indicator of that is the private investment, where we've gotten 49% state investment, but 51% of the investment has come from private industry. And I think that's the pure sign, is that they have recognized, wow, Oregon, you stepped up to the plate. We are going to put up a larger contribution of our own resources into what you're doing. So just would be interested to hear your vision for where we're headed.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Decker, thank you for the opportunity to raise that, because it does speak to the important things that we do besides that compelling interest on undergraduate access. And let me go on record as appreciating the work that Bob's done as Vice Chancellor for Engineering over the years. I think the engineering initiatives is one of the great successes that the system has had, and it's certainly one of the things that encouraged me to come to the state at a time when obviously state support was going to be a challenge. The willingness of private industry to step up to that plane. Let me place to you my personal commitment on this. What I'm seeking to do in the engagement of my staff, and the Chancellor's Office has indeed taken greater than proportional cuts in these things, as is the nature of systems and administrations. But what I'm looking at is the allocation of my time and what I do as Chancellor, and the engagement of my senior finance and academic officers. And I want us to be more engaged and more connected to the importance of research and engineering than we have been in the past. And that the efforts that Bob and others, and certainly the ETIC board and the somewhat related OCAD initiative that I know you're fully engaged in, have to some extent been a little out on the side, a little there, a wonderful addition and support for those of us engaged in the system. I don't want to operate that way. These initiatives are important enough to occupy my time and to occupy those of my senior staff, and that will be our place to do that. I haven't quite figured out how we're going to replace Bob's position. Bob had a lot of pressures on his time and has some very critical things to do as dean at PSU, and need to see him succeed in that arena too. But I can assure you that I will be much more engaged in this personally. I have called members of the ETIC board and told them, if you need a vice chancellor for engineering, call my number, I will show up. And I'll make sure I'm appropriately briefed on that. I wouldn't let me build anything, but I'll certainly show up and talk about it. It's critical that as we go into a tough time like this, that we retain those elements of activity that make us unique and make us competitive, and that we do that despite the fact we may be reducing a great many other things. So I will pledge to do that. I think the support of the state board has been there to do that, and we'll continue to work on that.
Mr. Chair, I would, in my line of kudos, I think I would give you a kudos in your brief time here. I've had the opportunity to spend a decent amount of time with you, and one of the things that I've really enjoyed is I see you very often, Lee, which is refreshing. I see you in my neck of the woods on ETIC and OCATE and the area that I roam. One of the concerns I might have is, can the Chancellor fulfill that role, and you would be the expert on that, but to me the coordination we had with the private industry and the successes that we were really building upon, and I'm wide open on this with no preconceived notion, but I guess it would be a concern that I would just toss out on the table, is can the Chancellor, with everything else, if I've gotten to see that much of you, I wonder, at Klamath Falls and Medford and other areas, can the Chancellor play that central role that I see has been so incredibly successful, and would just want to see us build upon it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Decker, well, thank you. And I've certainly made every effort that I can to get to Carroll Falls and Medford and Bend and LaGrande and Monmouth on all the bases that I can. The challenge for me is to keep the theme in place that staffs these initiatives and to make sure that as someone who works in the system, to always remember that the work is actually done on the campuses. That those of us in the system office don't teach a student, don't staff a lab, don't clean out a sink, don't mow a lawn, don't cook a meal. What we do is to try and help those activities, advocate for them, present them in places like this, and do the work of going out and organizing. I will tend to look to my colleague presidents and their staff and hold them accountable and much more engaged too. I feel that they are a critical part of the team that I work with, and I'll look to them to help us pull all of this together. I think we can do that.
Thank you. Been informative and, as pointed out, a daunting opportunity for us. So, if there's no further questions.
Well, I want to go back to that first slide of what we're going to do. That again.
The very first one.
Yeah. Well, not the horse, but yeah.
It may be a...
The horse and the...
Oh, you're on the horse line. I could do the... do the horse line. Let's see if I can get my way back through this a little quickly.
Well, if you can, I'll just...
No, we're talking software skills here. I can do that. Okay. Keep going. I'll go from the beginning.
Okay.
Oh, was the horse you were looking for?
No, the off the cliff. I think that was the same picture.
Well, it was.
Page 8.
Oh, there it is. Now, we just came from the Health Policy Committee, of which I'm the chair, and we also had a slide. Hmm. And that one was people going down in a raft, and the raft was tipping over, and all of these bodies were falling into the river. And that's where our health care is today.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked if that was a level 3 or a level 5, and he assured me it was a level 5, and I would be concerned if it was only a level 3 and we tipped over. So it's, this is the day, I guess, where we are looking disaster in the face, right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morrissey, I'm afraid so. They're real rocks. We're hoping there's a little snow on top of them to cushion the fall.
Well, I too really appreciate your efforts, and I did meet with you. I have the opportunity to meet with you, and Jane and I have met with you at the usual a couple of times, and I also had a great visit with people from OTI the other day, and I want them to come to our Health Policy Committee and talk about their expanded program. Because I know that they're doing things in Portland and so on in healthcare, and I think that's a dynamite program. And I have a former student at Springfield High School who spent 3 years at OTI, got his engineering degree on 3 years, and is now an entrepreneur and doing great. So I think that is a wonderful program, and we have lots of those around. So I'm totally supportive of what you're doing.
Thank you, sir.
And you have great help with your assistant, former speaker.
Thank you very much. It's been a wonderful presentation, and we look forward to working with you as we move forward in this session.
Thanks very much.
And
thank you.
We're going to close the informational hearing and adjourn the Senate Education Committee for the day.
After I change the time here.